Welcome to the National Association for Christian Recovery's audio workshop series. Additional audio recordings of workshops and plenary presentations from NACR conferences can be found at our website, www.nacr.org. Just click on the word audio in the top menu. The following is a plenary presentation from the STEPS 2005 conference. Our presenter is Dale Ryan, and the title of the presentation is Letting Go and Letting God. As always, we encourage you to take what works and leave the rest. Enjoy.
Well, the kind of overriding theme of our conference this time around has to do with spirituality. So I'm going to talk about that. A couple years ago, I broke my ankle. Not a fun thing to do. We were hiking on an island off the coast of Maine. They had to carry me on a stretcher for a couple miles, and on a boat to the mainland, and then 45 minutes to the hospital, take an x-ray. Then the doctor comes in and says, well, he broke three different breaks, and pretty common kind of thing, but there's some suggested things that I think will help you here. I'll make you some suggestions, and you can decide what to do. I said, let's do it. You know more than I do about this. Let's get this fixed. It did not occur to me to ask, well, is it biblical to put screws in your leg to fix a broken leg? That just didn't occur to me at the time. Didn't ask whether there's any spiritual significance to the suggested steps that he had for what I was doing. I just thought, this seems to work for other folks. So there's some suggested steps. I'll try what works for other folks. They'll cut off the leg, they'll put some screws in, and we'll see what happens. Now, if you're a Christian and you're addicted to something, and you go to a 12-step program or to a counselor or something else, and they say, well, here's some suggested steps that seem to work for a lot of folks. It's a little different, right? It occurs to us, well, is this Bible stuff? Now, that might just be the sort of a little bit of a denial system, another reason not to get help. But it also is an important question because, after all, recovery is fundamentally at its roots, down at the base of recovery. It's a process of spiritual change. It's not like, really, putting screws in your leg to fix a broken bone. It's about spiritual change. Something's going to have to change spiritually for us to be able to sustain sobriety, for us to be healthy after past trauma or wounds. And because it is fundamentally a spiritual process, it's perfectly legitimate for us to be asking whether it's consistent with the spiritual resources we trust and know about. And so one way to think about this talk really is that it's really about the Bible. The Bible is one of the most fundamental spiritual resources available to Christians. And I think it's really important to ask the question, is that Bible stuff? Is recovery stuff about Bible stuff or not? And so I thought what we'd do is just pick one simple recovery principle and ask, well, what's the Bible stuff about that? To see whether it's sort of a thin connection or a robust connection. And I landed on the slogan, that you all know, letting go and letting God. It's a pretty common recovery slogan. Some people don't like slogans. They don't think that something that fits on your bumper sticker could have much meaning. But I've always liked slogans. It seems to me to distill a lot of wisdom into a few words, letting go and letting God. And it has, there's a bunch of different language for that. It's about surrender. If you were in Akron, Ohio in the mid-1930s, that's the language you would have been using. It's about surrender. It's about letting God be God. The assumption is that this recovery is not something that I can just do. Somehow it's going to have to be something that God does. I may be able to get myself ready, but God's going to have to do the changing. Now, and it's so there's a sense in which it's really recovery is something we receive from God. There's plenty of stuff for us to do, right? But fundamentally, spiritually, it's about something we receive from God. And receiving is just not something that we're particularly good at. I've been watching my grandson, who knew how to receive from very early on. If you gave him a present in a box, it was like getting two presents, you know, because there's the box and then there's the present. And he just didn't have any problem receiving presents. You give him something and he just lights up. It's this kind of full body response. You know, it's like fantastic. This is, look at this. I mean, yeah, this is for me. I don't have any questions about that. I don't have any reservations about that. You give me something, well, that's just what the world is like. Nice people in my life who love me, give me things. And it just comes natural. Now, somewhere between, you know, 1.5 and 57, you lose that, right? All of us have lost that. We don't receive like that anymore. The big eyes, openness to anything, the welcoming. We're much more inclined to think, does this mean I should give them something back? You know? Or is this some kind of weird way to control my behavior? Or maybe, no, you shouldn't really. You know, there's some kind of shame about receiving. You shouldn't. There's somebody that needs this more than me. Why, I mean, no, please, no. I should be giving you things. You shouldn't be giving me things. I don't need more hats. I should be giving Jeff hats. Jeff gives me a hat. That's not right. And there's all these different layers of resistance that come up, so that receiving becomes really complicated territory. And I don't think that the Christian community as it exists today in modern America helps us very much here. I've spent my really entire life in the wing of the Christian church that emphasizes receiving at the very beginning of the Christian life. You sort of receive salvation. But from day two on, it's about giving. Right? It's about giving to God. It's about, I mean, all of the discipleship programs that I had been a part of, the sort of core thing was, we're going to teach you how to give to God. You know? This is how to be, worship is construed as something we give to God. Right? Worship isn't typically construed as something we receive from God. It's something we sort of psych up and give to God, like God needs that, so we're going to give God stuff, and it's our responsibility to do that well, because God needs it to be done really good, apparently. I don't know why that is, but we get kind of locked in somehow to this giving mode. Now, there's nothing wrong with giving. Don't go home and say, Dale Ryan said there's something wrong with giving. But what I'm going to try to argue today, not really an argument, is it? What I'm going to suggest today, that one of the fundamental, most fundamental of recovery principles is that you have to be willing to receive. Yeah, I don't know how many of you have spent time trying to stay sober by just doing sobriety instead of receiving sobriety. But it's kind of a hard path. I've known people who've been able to do that for some period of time, but you just get old and grouchy. Because it's, you know, because you have to work hard and work harder and work your hardest and get tired. That's what happens. You just get old and tired. So I thought we'd, you know, I know in many Christian programs you'll get, I've even drafted papers like this myself that'll show the 12 steps. Each of the 12 steps of AA, and alongside of it, there'll be a Bible verse that sort of authenticates the step. You know, it says, "Oh, well, it's got to be Bible stuff because they're a verse." You know, those are kind of very useful first observations that there's a connection between the recovery process and the biblical text. But it's kind of what's called proof texting, right? It's just kind of finding one verse that happens to mention something kind of close to this. I think it's really important at this stage in the development of the Christian recovery movement for us to be asking for deeper connections to the biblical text. Is this stuff just, you know, mentioned in a verse somewhere offhand, not a big deal? Or is this really important stuff? So we'll take one principle, letting go and letting God. And I'm going to walk you through the entire Bible. I've chosen as my text for this morning the entire Bible. I wanted to say that, for a long time. Does that sound grandiose to anybody? All right. I may have to leave some parts out. But let's start in the beginning. In Genesis, there's the accounts of creation. What's the main point of the account of creation? God gives life, we receive life. That's the bottom line. I know that in a lot of traditions right now, when you think about Genesis, you think it's about, you know, narratives about stuff that happened a long time ago. This is in part because of scientific controversy and all that kind of stuff. It just seems like stuff that's very old. It's very clear, I think, if you look closely at this text, that it's not intended to be about stuff that happened a long time ago. It's a description about what the basic structure of existence on this planet is like. The basic structure of life on this planet is God gives life, we receive life. It's also very clear in the text that it's not God gave life and we live life. God gives life and gives life and gives life and we receive, receive, receive. The creator didn't stop being the creator when he created. God is still the creator. He's still giving life and we are still receiving life. None of us can guarantee the next beat of our heart. Each of us sitting here in this room right now cannot guarantee we'll be alive at the end of the hour. Every beat of your heart is a gift from the Creator God, the ruler of the universe, a gift of love and grace to you. It's very hard to stay in conscious contact with that gift of love and grace from God as you live through a day. It just seems like too much to pay attention to somehow. But it's the most fundamental truth that you find at the very beginning of the book. God gives and gives and gives. He is giving to you all day long. And your task is to receive and receive and receive. Now, let's fast forward, since we're going to have to do a lot of that. Talk about Abraham, first really major character. God comes out of the blue, he comes to Abraham. And he says, I'm going to give you stuff. I'm going to give you a land, I'm going to give you lots of children, and I'm going to make you to be a blessing. Okay, now the most significant thing there is God comes to Abraham and he says, I'm going to give to you. Abraham's world was a very religious world. There were all kinds of religions out and about, and the dominant sort of instinct of all those religious faiths is that it was our responsibility to give to God. Maybe God's hungry and he needs to be fed, so you give him food. Maybe God's angry and we need to give God something so he won't be angry. But it's the dynamic is we're going to give to God. That was the only sort of religious instinct available in Abraham's world. And out of nowhere comes this God who says just the opposite. This would have been the first time Abraham heard anything like this. A God shows up and says, I'm going to give to you. Abraham has got no internal structure for understanding that. This is turning his world upside down. A God who gives, not a God who needs to receive. So it must have been really, really shocking. And it's very clear that Abraham doesn't get it right away. He's slow, Abraham. He's slow. You know, God says, I'm going to give you a land, I'm going to give you lots of kids, I'm going to make you to be a blessing. There's stuff for Abraham to do here, right? This is not about being passive. Abraham is to, God's giving a land, he has to go to the land. I probably do not need to explain to you, being an adult audience, what Abraham has to do to have lots of kids, but he has to be a dad. So he has to be about the business of having lots of kids. And he has to be about the business of being a blessing. He's going to go to the land, he's going to have lots of kids, and all his neighbors, after a period of time, are going to say, you know, it's just a blessing to have you in the neighborhood. That's the vision. They're all going to look at Abraham and say, we're just a lot better off because you're here. It's just a blessing to have you here. That's God's vision. That's God's promise. And Abraham, being a bright boy, has a different plan. He doesn't understand God giving to him. his plan involves him devising an alternative plan, plan B. God's plan A was go to the land. Abraham's plan B, he goes to Egypt. Bad choice. God's plan A was have lots of kids. Abraham's plan B, was he gets to Egypt. Pharaoh thinks his wife is hot, wants her. Abraham says, she's my sister, you can have her. This is like taking some time to get the idea. Right? God's plan for Abraham is he's going to be a blessing. By the time he's done in Egypt, the Pharaoh says, you've become a curse to us. Okay, so Abraham gets it all wrong. God says, I'm going to give. Abraham says, I don't get that. I'm going to have to do this other stuff. I got deals that I'm making. I got arrangements. I got other plans. We're going to do plan B. And, you know, after that, eventually he does get back to the land. He does have kids. There is that terrifying story that I don't have time to fully talk about, where he takes his son to sacrifice his son. You remember this terrifying story that no one really preaches on very much because it's so terrifying. I think what's really going on there is Abraham takes his son and he's going to kill his son. It's a story about human sacrifice, very common thing in Abraham's world, because all the religious instincts in Abraham's world is you have to give really important stuff to God, because God needs stuff, so you got to give really your best stuff to God. The bottom line of the story, of course, is God comes and God says, that's not the deal. It's not about you giving to me. It's about me giving to you. Here's the sacrifice. I give you the sacrifice. Don't go the way I know that your whole world is about you giving to God, but the deal is I'm giving to you. That's the deal. Took Abraham a good deal of time to figure that out. Abraham's life powerfully reinforced the sort of order of creation. God gives and gives and gives. And we receive, and receive. Now, I know if we sort of fast forward a little bit more to the whole, the first objection people typically raise to this is the whole sacrificial system in the Old Testament. People are giving sacrifices to God. I mean, they're giving to God, right? Well, I'd just like to spend a couple minutes talking about one text that I really enjoy, Deuteronomy 12, 15-18, that talks about the details of what it's like to give your sacrifices to God. The premise is you're living in this little extended family clan, and after harvest and after the young animals are born, the sheep and the goats, you've been blessed by God. So the whole deal starts out with God giving. God gives an increase to your flock. Okay, try to think like a peasant farmer for just a moment. When we eat meat, we go to the store and buy meat. I don't know where they made that meat, but it's just, you know, meat. We don't, most of us have a sense that this comes from killing animals, right? But in the ancient world, there was a very direct connection between the animal and being blessed by God. If you don't have young animals in your flock this year, you may not be able to make it through the winter. You may not survive. If God doesn't give you crops, you may not live. There may not be anything down the street at the grocery store. There's no grocery store to go to. So you take the stuff that's essential for your survival, and what do you do with it? This is the narrative of what to do after God has given blessing. God has given animals, given crops. Nevertheless, you may slaughter your animals in any of your towns and eat as much of the meat as you want. Okay, so first, the whole thing starts out, God gives. And then the next thing is you're supposed to have a party. You're supposed to eat as much as you want. Okay, and it goes on, eat as much of the meat as you want, as if it were gazelle or deer, according to the blessing the Lord your God gives you. Both the ceremonially unclean and the clean may eat it. So invite over not only the people you normally invite over, but invite everybody over. People who are ceremonially clean and unclean, this is the time, just invite everybody over, have a big party, eat as much as you want. All right, so it starts off, God gives, and then there's this party where you eat as much as you want. Does this sound like a sacrifice yet? God gives, eat as much as you want, you invite everybody. There's a few conditions. There's two, really. Don't eat the blood poured out on the ground. Second one, don't eat the tithe. That is, of all the blessings God's given you and you've received, set aside 10%, or you might be other additional things that you've set aside. You promise God an extra 5% of your crops or something. You don't, when you eat everything, you can still eat everything you want, but don't eat that stuff. Okay? Now, what happens to that stuff? You must not eat in your own towns the tithe of your grain and new wine and oil or the firstborn of your herds and flocks or whatever you have vowed to give or your freewill offerings or special gifts. Don't eat that. Instead, you are to eat them in the presence of the Lord your God at the place your God will choose. So God's going to choose this special place, and you're going to go there and eat it. All right? So God gives you stuff. You have a big party, but you save back 10%, and God says, there's a special party town. We're going to go there, and we're going to have another party. Listen to how it says what you do when you get to the special party town. Take it to the place the Lord God will choose, your sons and daughters, your men servants and maid servants, and the Levites from your towns, and you are to rejoice before the Lord your God in everything you put your hand to. You're supposed to go to the party town, and there you spend 10% of your annual income on having another party. Does this sound like a sacrifice yet? Okay, so you have God gives you a bunch of stuff. You eat all you want, set aside 10%, go to a special place, and you eat it there with your whole extended family. Now, if I spent 10% of my rather modest annual income on a party, we would have one good jazz band, I'm telling you. We would have a really good party. 10% of your annual income. Does that sound like giving to God, sort of sacrificial giving to God? This is like God gives and gives and gives and gives, and we receive and receive and receive. Don't think the sacrificial system in the Old Testament was about people, you know, scarcity model thinking. This is about God gives in abundance, and our task fundamentally is to receive. It's intriguing that the text has to say, when you get to this town where you're going to have a party with 10% of your annual income, you are to rejoice before the Lord. You are to enjoy this. As it's if God is anticipating that we'll be very anxious about all this receiving. He says, I mean, it's not like an obligation to have certain emotions. He's saying, look, if you get stuck in a performance thing here, try to get past that, because I really want you to have a good time at these two parties. Because I'm giving you and giving you and giving you. I want you to receive and have a good time. It takes us a while to get that to the place where we can really enjoy that, but that's part of the task. God gives and gives and gives, and we receive, receive, receive. Let's go forward to Gideon. This is quite a while later. I'll spare you the details. Gideon was a military commander. This is a time in history when the tribes of Israel were kind of a loose confederation. There was a military threat from the east. There's, you know, pillagers coming in from the Syrian desert. And this guy named Gideon put together an army, 32,000 men for that time. This is shock and awe. I mean, this is a very powerful force. And there's a narrative there about this battle that Gideon's going to be engaged in. Most of you know this story. And the story is not in the text because it was a historically important battle. This was a skirmish, one of many skirmishes. It's not there because of the history. It's there because of a conversation between Gideon and God. I'm going to paraphrase this to save us some time. Gideon comes to God after he raises this big army, 32,000 men, and says to God, I think we can give you the victory. And God says, this does not feel right. You giving me the victory. Something about that doesn't feel right. Because I want to give you the victory. And you've got all this shock and awe thing going. You know, if you go out with this army and win, people are just going to say, well, it was the shock and awe. It was the powerful stuff. You get all this state-of-the-art military hardware, and you won because you were more strong than the other guy. It didn't involve me at all. And God didn't like that. God says, you know, I'm just going to feel much more comfortable about this whole thing if you send a bunch of these people home and go out to fight this with less impressive military forces. So Gideon sends, you know, half of them home. And remember, this goes on. There's two or three cycles of this. God keeps telling him to send people home until Gideon comes to God and says, I do not think that I can give you the victory. And God says, I think we're ready to get something done. I think we're ready to get something done. Because I'm the one who gives and gives and gives. And you're the one that receives and receives and receives. If you ever, you can try to do recovery out of a center of strength, you know. You raise 32,000 men, you can go out to battle. It doesn't work very well. You just try and try harder, try your hardest, get tired. That's what happens. That's what would have been Gideon's fate if God hadn't come and said, you know, we're going to have to do this out of weakness, or I just don't know how I can help you. There is something about weakness that God finds very attractive. God has promised to use our weakness. He's not promised to use our strengths. I'm not saying that sometimes God doesn't use our giftedness and strengths, but there's very specific promises that God's made about using our weakness. Now, I think in this story you get a sense of the terror that comes from receiving from God. If the story about the sacrificial system in the Old Testament is a story about receiving that leads to partying and so on, the story of Gideon is a reminder that the kind of work we have to do is pretty scary work, because it means going out against an enemy where we know we cannot do this on our own strength. And there's a vulnerability and a fears that come up. How is this going to work if I can't make it work? How is this going to work if I'm not powerful enough to make this work? That's some of the scariest work we do in the recovery process, is facing our weaknesses, bringing them to God, and being shocked again by God's response that if we're weak, He can be strong. Let's skip forward over a bunch of stuff I really love. I don't have time to talk about the prophets, but if you look at the prophets, you'll see story after story just like this, where God insists on being the one who gives and us on being the ones who receives. But let's talk about Jesus. All you who labor and who are burdened, I will give you rest. I'll give, you receive. I'll give you rest. You will find rest for your soul. Soul rest. What is soul rest? If we didn't have the word serenity, we'd use that. Okay. God wants to give that. I'll give that to you, Jesus says. Jesus reaffirming the kind of basic order of creation. There's a creator who gives life, gives good things, and there's creatures, and we receive life, receive good things. When Jesus taught his disciples how to pray, it was, give us this day. Give, God, you be the one to give. We'll be the ones who receive. We have time for one parable, my favorite, the prodigal son. It's with, of course, the parable of the waiting father. If you take an introductory course on parables at Fuller or any place else, one of the first things you'll learn is that parables tend to have one point, that they're not a lot about a lot of five-point sermons. They're usually parables about one thing. With the parable of the prodigal son, unfortunately, people try to take that principle, and they only wind up preaching about the first half. They'll preach about the son that left and, you know, spent his money on cocaine and prostitutes. I'm just guessing. I think it's a good guess. I think it's a good guess. He wasn't buying CDs, you know, I don't think. And he comes back home, and you just preach on that. But there's two sons in the story. And sort of the sort of central question to interpret this parable is, what's the one point of the whole parable? And you have to ask, what do these two sons have in common? this son that went off and spent his money on cocaine and prostitutes, and the son that was at home and has a bunch of resentments. Well, if you ask that question, what do these two sons have in common? It won't take you very long looking at the text to figure it out, I don't think. Both of these sons have essentially the same strategy for how they're going to be part of the father's family. The prodigal son, what's his strategy? He's walking home and he's practicing the speech. He's going to get home and he's going to say, blah, 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 I will be your servant. That's his strategy for how to get back into the father's family. I'm going to be a servant. What does a servant do? A servant gives. A servant gives and gives and gives. And the father, great and grateful father, receives, receives, receives. So he gets home. He doesn't really get his whole speech out before the father's saying, that's not the deal. I'm the one that gives and gives and gives. And you be the one that receives and receives and receives. This must have been profoundly confusing to this young boy who just knew that the only way to get back in the good graces of his father was to give. And the father confuses him. I have often thought that it must have been an awkward time for him at that party, you know, because he probably doesn't quite get it yet. Why, you know, I thought I was going to give and give and give, and here I'm just got to receive and receive and receive, and it doesn't feel right yet because his brain is altered, you know. Now, the other son, what's his strategy? When it becomes apparent that he has some resentments, his father has a conversation with him, and what does the older brother say? He says, I have served you all this time. The son says, I've been giving and giving and giving. And now this guy gets honored. It doesn't seem right. So the older son has the same strategy as the younger son. He thinks that he gets to be part of the father's family because he's giving and giving and giving. And the father says to him, you know, everything I have is yours. I'm the one that gives. I'm going to give and give and give. Focus on receiving, receiving, receiving. It's a great, great story, great recovery story, great recovery principle. That's really what it looks like to let go and let God. Let go of that need to be the one who gives. There's a lot of control control issues that have to work here. The one who's giving gifts has a one-up kind of power sometimes. And that feels better to us than the weakness of receiving. Last time I talked about this, someone came up afterwards and said, well, what about Romans 12, presenting your body as a living sacrifice? So I thought I'd talk about that for a few minutes. Don't have time to talk about all of Romans, but in Romans, the first 11 chapters of Romans can be summarized by this. God gives and gives and gives. That's the first 11 chapter of the book, first 11 chapters of the book of Romans. God's a God that gives and gives and gives. He's using different language. He's talking about grace. He's talking about all kinds of things that made sense to a Jewish audience in his time. But that's the basic point. He ends the 11th chapter of Romans saying, can anyone give to God? Can anyone give to God? I mean, it's very Pauline. Every once in a while, he just sort of breaks out in this sort of, you know, magnificent poem-like thing. He says, nobody can give to God. God's given and given and given. Nobody can give to God. And then a couple of verses later, he says, present your body as a living sacrifice. So the first thing to note about that is that while we tend to think that sacrifice is losing something, God thinks of sacrifice as, I'm going to give and give and give, make sure you have two parties and really enjoy it. Okay? So if you're going to sacrifice your body, think about having two parties and really enjoying it. Okay? I know you can go very strange places with that, but it's not about deprivation. It's not about losing things. It's about God honoring the good creation that he's made, giving you a wonderful body. If you're going to sacrifice that, that is going to be to celebrate that. It's not to lose it. And all the images that I think tend to come to most people's minds are really negative ones. It's, you know, dying. Sacrifice means I should die, not I should be celebrated. which I think is much closer to the Paul's meaning there. Paul, in other places, is very colorful about this because, of course, the early church, the Christian church doesn't have a golden age. I hope everybody understands that. We don't look back to a time when everything was just the way it was supposed to be. Right? It's like you go back, read the New Testament, you find very troubled, broken people trying to find some way to honor Jesus, to live that kind of life, trying to learn how to receive. And you find in all of Paul's letters, I think, that one of the key things that started to go wrong is that people really wanted this to be about us getting it right. Us giving to God by getting it right. Or us giving to God in some way. Let's make this about us being the good people who give to God. And Paul keeps coming back in a variety of different ways, depending on the context, and saying, you know, that's not the deal. This really is about grace. And grace is about what? It's about a God who gives and gives and gives, and people who receive and receive and receive. Now, I know that you've heard sermons to the contrary. I have heard many sermons in my life about all the things I was supposed to give to God. I was, in fact, at one stage of my life, felt like I was in charge of God's mood. That, you know, if I did these things, God was happy. And if I did things, God was sad. You have to imagine a seven-year-old's mindset here. It now strikes me as a sort of odd thought that I would think I was powerful enough to be in charge of God's mood, a very fragile sort of God. I don't know what sort of psychological labels you might want to put on that God, but it's not very sturdy. If he's you know, getting sad every time I do this, and angry when I do this, and happy when I do this, it's like a God on a chain, sort of linked to me. That sort of power thing is what comes when we are in charge. We are in charge. And there is nothing more debilitating to our spiritual lives than that sense that we are in charge. We're going to be the ones who give. We're going to be the ones who make this work. We're going to be the ones that are good enough, strong enough, wise enough, biblical enough, Christian enough, Jesus enough to make this whole thing work. All you get out of that is you got to try hard, you got to try harder, you got to try your hardest and get tired. That's all you get out of that kind of spirituality. Paul was pretty ruthless about this stuff. The gospel of us being the ones to give and God being the ones to receive, he says, it's another gospel. It's just not about what we're about at all. It's not what we're about at all. Let me say something about the book of Revelations so that we've really done justice to talking about the whole Bible. If you look at the very end of the book, let's go all the way to the end. There's kind of a footnote in the last chapter of Revelations that doesn't appear in the earliest manuscripts. If you look at the very last verse that appears in the earliest manuscripts, it says this: whoever is thirsty, let him come. And whoever wishes, let him take the free gift of the water of life. If you're hungry, if you're thirsty, God wants to feed you. I don't know that comes instinctively to us. I do think that the Judeo-Christian tradition is unique in the history of world religions in having a God that feeds his people. I think most religious instincts in the history of our species have been we need to feed God somehow. Think about manna in the wilderness. Think about God setting a table for us in the presence of our enemies. Think about loaves and fishes. that provide for us. Think of the Eucharist, God feeding us with spiritual food. God loves to feed his people. He loves to give nourishment to us. And our task is to receive that. Now, if you went on past the last chapter in Revelation and started to look at the history of the church, I think what you'll see is that there have been large segments in the history of the Christian church where people lost the order of creation, where they lost this sense that God's the one who gives and we're the ones who receive. And it got turned around. And there have been bright moments when it got turned back right again. I think the Protestant Reformation is an example of one of those moments when the main point was to get back to God's the one who gives, and we are the ones who receive. One final fast forward, let's talk about right now. Sitting in this chapel, who gives and who receives? I wish this was an easier issue for us than it is. I know in my own journey there have been all kinds of times when it felt like the appropriate thing to do was for me to be in charge. When I forget that it was my best thinking that got me to where I got. And times when I have needed to be called back to a very simple truth. That I need to let go of all that and receive from God. It's not a good sermon about passivity. There's nothing passive about this. We need to do whatever it takes to become entirely ready, as the 12 steps says. Becoming entirely ready for God to change us. But if we're spending the energy on changing us, we're doing God's job. We have to do the work of becoming ready to change, and there's a substantial amount of work there to be done. Now, let me just close with the thought that God invites us to receive today. That wherever you've been, whatever the texture of your recovery journey, and we have just a huge range of diverse journeys that God has led us on. There is no one-size-fits-all recovery journey. Am I right about that? Just each of us has a unique story. That's why it's so important for us to hear each other's stories. Each of us, every day, faces the issue of who's going to be in charge of my recovery today. And the best advice, really, something that sums up one of the what I believe to be the main themes of the Bible is let go and let go. I commend that to you as a good way to start a day. Thanks for letting me talk.